Good afternoon, everyone. It's Dr. Nigro again with our next episode of Psychology Unplugged. As always, a heartfelt thank you to all of our followers here in the United States and across the globe. It's a pleasure to be able to offer this to you guys as a source of education and information. And I really enjoy the conversations I've had each of the weeks I've been doing this podcast. And I appreciate the insight and the feedback. And it's really cool how many people are going into the field of psychology, because I know here in the United States, and at least from talking with people in pretty significantly industrialized countries and areas, just the paucity of resources for mental health providers or for individuals suffering with mental health. There are just not enough providers, and there's certainly not enough good providers. So if any of you guys are interested in going into this field, it is desperate for people who have a passion for helping other people. It certainly is my passion. I hopefully that comes across in the podcasts, and I thoroughly enjoy doing this on a weekly basis. So we're going to go back to one of my favorite areas of diagnostics is the personality disorders. But this is one that I haven't done yet. And it's I'm not sure why, but I haven't done this one yet. But it's something that I do encounter and diagnose, I wouldn't say on a regular basis, but it's not that uncommon. It's certainly a personality disorder that is definitely tends to be more common in males. Why that is, not sure. But personality disorders are interesting from my perspective. I just find them fascinating because it's really the psychological constitution of who a person is. And rarely do people come in enter into psychotherapy with the belief that they have personality disorders. I have noticed that a lot of people from the podcast that I've communicated with through various mediums have asked to be evaluated. You know, I'm so grateful for people who've come from very far distances to work with me and allow me to do a full neuropsych eval to give you some diagnostic clarification. But people generally don't enter into psychotherapy saying, "I have a personality disorder." Like I was saying, a lot of people from this program have asked their providers to evaluate them further, borderline being one of the most prominent, and also I think dependent and avoidant and schizoid. Rarely, if ever, do narcissists enter into the psychotherapeutic realm, and if it is, it's usually for a reason that's not related to deep insight and a Adlerian aha moment. It's often at the result of being court ordered or part of probation, or if you're putting on a show, couples therapy, especially when assets are at stake, or sometimes when people really do hit rock bottom. So this personality disorder that I'm going to cover today is what's called schizotypal personality disorders. And anytime I think people hear the word schizo, which means split, there's an immediate cause for alarm and panic, because schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, which is essentially schizophrenia with depression, not to minimize it, but that's essentially what schizoaffective disorder is. Schizotypal is actually a personality disorder. And in the diagnostic manual, we have different groupings, the neurodevelopmental disorders, the anxiety disorders, traumas, the depressive disorders, the bipolar, the mood disorders, neurocognitive, and then we have the whole section on personality disorders. So this is not an actual psychotic disorder, although sometimes the actual symptom manifestation can look very much like what we used to have as an axis one, a clinical disorder like schizophrenia or psychosis, a brief psychotic episode. But it's an interesting disorder. And remember, with personality, it's fascinating and it's scary to think about that those imprints and the foundations, the tenets of who we are formulated between 5 and 8 years of age. And the earlier that you can identify disordered thinking and behaviors and get in child, early adolescent in for a neuropsych eval to get them properly diagnosed, because if there is a personality disorder, earlier identification of anything, you know, whether psychiatric conditions or medical conditions, generally lead to a better prognosis and outcome. But I didn't have my notes for this one because I want to make a clear distinction between this is, I did one on schizoid. This is very different, schizotypal. So really, like the core feature of schizotypal is a pervasive pattern of like social and interpersonal deficits. So, you know, by being pervasive, it's across all environments. That's hence why it's personality, because it doesn't matter whether it's at work, whether it's at home, whether it's at church, whether it's at the grocery store, it's pervasive. And it's really about acute discomfort and reduced capacity for close relationships. Sometimes there will be cognitive or perceptual distortions. And these individuals are often eccentric. They have eccentric behavior. And it's the MMPI, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, which is one I use on a pretty regular basis, is really good at being able to pick up these, because there's several different scales, whether they're the clinical scales or the restructured clinical scales or the content scales, the supplementary scales or the Psi-5 scales. It's really able to parse out psychopathology and is an amazing instrument that I use. And that's what's called one of the more objective personality tests versus the Rorschach or the thematic apperception tests, both of which I use every day, are also really good, because the Rorschach is really a test of personality, similar to the TAT. So individuals with schizotypal have what are called ideas of reference, which is basically like a wrong interpretation of incidents and events as having a particular and unusual meaning specific for that person. So the event is interpreted as referring specifically unto themselves. There's important distinction that this is not about delusions of reference as related to psychosis or in terms of cultural issues, which like I referenced in the back of the DSM, there's a whole list of cultural disorders. I've only come across one or two. They're very rare, and I think it was the book Fractured Minds, when one of my neuropsych classes, that I was able to remember something from that book and go back to that book and figure out a case where it was much more culturally related, even though the behavior seemed this is definitely clinically significant as how we would interpret them from a Western culture. So the schizotypals, and again, I'm just using that for the term of being general without any kind of trying to be disparaging or dismissive to anybody who is struggling with this condition or is in a relationship with somebody with this condition. But they're very superstitious. They're preoccupied with like paranormal phenomena, like special powers. They'll talk about ESP, believe they have a sense of what's about to happen. They can read other people's thoughts. Now that does seem somewhat odd. That does seem, you know, if I step back into my role as an objective scientist practitioner model, that's generally not how people navigate through the world. Although somebody could be hypervigilant, that could also be someone who has a history of trauma. And that could also be somebody who may have other psychiatric conditions that are coexisting, which they generally always are with the personality disorders. Again, hence why it's so crucial to get the neurosync eval, because it's able to parse out what it is and what it is not. But this allusion to having special powers and ESP and really being able to kind of sense what's about to happen. They also believe they have like magical control over other people. They believe like their spouse has taken their dog out for a walk because they had that thought an hour earlier. Magical rituals like walking past an object three times to avoid harmful outcomes. Now that kind of sounds a little bit like OCD. So it's this mystical, ritualistic, otherworldly thinking. Again, not psychotic, but definitely, I hope you can see as I'm articulating this the best I can, odd and eccentric. So if they have to do these things in a ritualistic way, like walking past a light pole three times or turning around in a circle three times, and I've seen this in my office. I have literally seen these behaviors. And I think I look at it not from a perspective of, oh my, holy cow. I've been looking at it more from perspective of awe and appreciation for, of seeing it's one thing to hear anecdotally what someone's symptoms are, but to actually witness them is from my perspective, is a very privileged opportunity, because unless you really see this, I mean, it only helps you, I think, at least from my perspective, is helping me become a better diagnostician. But this is very, clothing can be very distinct. How the person walks is very distinct, and it's all meant in terms to kind of circumvent things from happening, or that there's other powers that may be surrounding. Again, not psychotic, but definitely, like I said, odd and eccentric. Perceptual alterations may be present, like sensing that another person is present or hearing a voice murmuring their name. That's a common one. A lot of adolescents hear this, but it's really not psychotic. Common, they'll hear like whispers. A lot of times auditory hallucinations start out as whispers that are kind of indistinguishable, not really tell if it's, male or female, if it's something coming external or internal. I talked about that on the episode with schizophrenia, but, these are sub-vocalizations from Broca's area, which is our expressive language area, the brain, versus Wernicke's area. Another thing that's interesting is someone with schizotypal, their speech usually includes like unusual or idiosyncratic phrasing and construction. It's loose, it's digressive, it's vague, but they're not incoherent. They're storytellers, but in a way that it's like, yeah, that could be possible. Versus somebody who may have a blatant delusion or hallucination, but the speech is very, the phrasing, the terminology, I found in many instances can be very articulate at times. But when you say incoherent, that would just mean like word salad or neologisms. Word salad is just mumbling words together that have no connection whatsoever, like lime, potato, TV, computer. Like that, that's word salad, just mixing it up. And derailment is just kind of going off in multiple tangents, which you can sometimes see if someone's in a manic or hypomanic episode. Let's call them flight of ideas. But it's interesting how the individuals speak, because it is very coherent, and the responses they're either overly concrete or incredibly abstract, and words and concepts. They're sometimes used in unusual ways, but it's this mindset. And you know, as I'm going through my structured diagnostic clinical interview, and you know, the referral is, you know, is a lot of times the referral is the psychosis, which is something you definitely, you know, mindful of as I'm, you know, designing a test battery and doing an assessment and gathering information. But the speech, what you also notice is there's not a lot of psychomotor agitation or restlessness, which you can often see, a lot of times someone see who is in someone who's in an active phase of psychosis. These individuals are also incredibly suspicious, and they may have paranoid ideations. I did an episode on paranoid personality disorder, but they may have paranoid ideations, like they believe that their colleagues are talking about that at work, and the colleagues are undermining their attempt to take over their position and go to their boss. So there's that level of paranoid ideation, and again, is this paranoia? Is this trauma? Maybe this person has had an experience where people did talk about them and people did undermine them, and it's really helpful, at least from my perspective, in doing the diagnostic piece. But this is the other, you know, part, because these individuals are often loners, and because of their interpersonal discomfort that they feel, they're often not coming in with a spouse or a family member, which is, you know, in the case of this, is really helpful that, you know, if someone says, yeah, they've had these experiences in the past, that this is something that, you know, they, you know, had colleagues that undermined them, and they did this and this and this, that the, you know, the more information I can get, obviously, the better it is in terms of just gathering information, you know, to get that background information. Where's my writing here? They're really not able to show a full range of affect, emotional expressions, and interpersonal relationships. And that's why their relationships are not often very successful. They often interfere with others in a really inappropriate, stiff, and constricted fashion, and I think that makes it difficult, you know, whether that comes to dating or a job that requires a high degree of social competence. And you know, if as I'm talking about this, you kind of see, you know, is there some possibility of an autism spectrum disorder diagnosis here? Because again, the interpersonal deficits, but in interacting with them, they seem to just, they're very stiff and they're rigid and they're awkward. And it's kind of the person that he's like, you know, honey, if John comes over, you know, can you come over and get me from the conversation? Because it's awkward in talking with them. And they're, like I said, they're considered odd and eccentric because of their mannerisms. And they often appear unkempt, and their manner of dress doesn't quite fit together. I'm not saying they're slovenly, but again, the odd and eccentric, without any regard for what the response or societal response may be. And something common in schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, is poor hygiene. And again, this is part of the diagnostic process, but this is an individual who's just going about their day, and they don't care that they don't haven't showered. They don't care that, you know, their teeth are brown from drinking tons of coffee, and they have a distinct look about them, which is, you know, slovenly. And they really have inattention with to the usual like social conversation. They avoid eye contact. They could wear clothes that have ink stain. They really don't. Aren't able to kind of have that give and take dialogue or banter in a relationship. But again, that sounds a lot like autism. It could sound like somebody maybe with avoidant personality or schizoid, who's just, you know, again, these are these or something with social anxiety. But the indifference, I think, is a crucial part of it. Is they're not like, oh my god, there's ink on my shirt. They're like, yeah, I don't understand why you're making a big deal about that. Not to say that, you know, it's not, I don't think it's ignorance. I think it's just that, again, that indifference. So they're kind of usually easy to spot, to at least kind of pique your interest, like, that indifference, as opposed to, the, you know, not feeling shame or embarrassment. And, you know, this is not going to a costume party. This is just how they go about their, you know, everyday life. But, you know, individuals with schizotypal, they really experience interpersonal relatedness as problematic. And they're incredibly uncomfortable relating to other people. You know, but they do, what's a little different than the schizotypal, they can express unhappiness about their lack of relationships. But their behavior suggests a real decreased need for intimate contact or relationships, where the schizoid is really kind of indifferent. As we, so, you know, someone is the avoidant, but very similar with the schizoid. They're indifferent. The schizotypal, and this is where, you know, doing diagnostics, you make these fine delineations that schizotypal may want or express concern about a lack of meaningful involvement with other people. Little different than when you get the schizoid. So consequently, they generally have no or just a few close friends other than first degree relatives. Extremely anxious in social situations, especially with unfamiliar people. The creatures of habit again sounds a lot like autism. You know sameness and, you know, routines, but really anxious in social situations, but they will interact with other individuals when they have to, but they definitely prefer to keep to themselves. Again, a major difference between schizoid and schizotypal. The schizotypal will interact. They would prefer not to, but they will. But they just don't fit in, and their social anxiety does not easily just go away, even when they spend more time with people and become more familiar. And I think the anxiety really with is related in schizotypal diagnostically is really related to the suspiciousness regarding others' motivation. So if you think about it, even if you are going to engage, but you still operate from the mindset and the perspective that the world is a dangerous and hostile place. Again, I am, others are, the world is, that, you know, the three and the therefores, the hence, you know, the basic construct of personality. If you believe the world is a hostile place and other people are out to get you, that's kind of the framework of how a schizotypal will navigate the environment and their social world from a place of suspiciousness and mistrust. Obviously, it's at some point in development, because of his personality, they learn the world is a hostile and dangerous place, and people are to be avoided, and people are to be not trusted. So even though, like I said, even though they will interact, the suspiciousness, they're constantly questioning the motivations of other people, and their relationships, intimate ones, if they're able to sustain them, generally are very strained, where they think their spouse is cheating. And if they have magical powers and they suspect that there's, they concoct worst case scenarios. And again, the MMPI is a great instrument in being able to help, because the one of the scales, the schizophrenia scale, the paranoia scale, the scale psychasthenia, those are great in being able to kind of parse out, because at different levels, what are called the scores are converted to T scores, different levels. Each of the they mean different things. This is where you're really kind of getting into, you know, it's not just a summation of the score, but the totality of doing diagnostics and doing critical item analysis, where you dig deeper into the test and do cross comparison analyses to really figure out and hone in what is exactly contributing to these different responses, which helps in facilitating the whole diagnostic process. And again, I do this for a living. It's much easier to just allude to it than to explain, because to explain the inner workings of my mind, I could try, but I don't know. I don't know how that would work, because it's just how my mind thinks. But you know, it's like I said, individuals with schizotypal don't go seeking treatment for schizotypal. They seek treatment for anxiety and depression. And in response to stress, these individuals can experience transient psychotic episodes lasting a few minutes to a few hours. But rarely is it to a degree that is sufficient to warrant a diagnosis of a true psychotic disorder, like schizophrenia, schizophreniform disorder, true psychosis. But in some cases, you know, psychotic symptoms do develop that do meet criteria for schizophreniform disorder, delusional disorder, and schizophrenia. I'm not saying this is a precursor, but in some cases, it can turn into that. Major depressive disorder is probably one of the most common co-occurring disorders with schizotypal. I would probably say bipolar as well. But there's, you know, there's a lot of overlap and co-occurrence with schizoid, paranoid, avoidant, and borderline personality disorders. And, you know, you're able, again, this is why I'm so adamant, and I say this ad nauseum, but again, the people who've gone through the process see the utility and the benefit of having a full neuropsych eval, because, you know, the art of diagnostics and the science behind diagnostics is able to generate accurate information and rule out all these other things that it's not, and be able to say with certainty this is what it is. And once you know what it is, then you're able to treat it. But it's an interesting disorder, and it's one I think that does have some, you know, pretty observable characteristics. A lot of times it's really the dress and the eccentricities, and you see these observable behaviors, and I've seen them in my office. I've seen them as a student working on inpatient units, running a psychiatric hospital. I really just find the personality disorders fascinating, and as you can see, there's, you know, different symptom overlap. But it is something that is treatable, and it is something that is able to be diagnosed through, you know, the standardized tests and measures that we have. But most people, when I've done the episode on schizoid and avoidant and probably schizotypal, so they'd never even heard of these before. Because it looks like so many other things, and the only way to really know is to get a full eval. You know, is medication, it really doesn't work. And, you know, when you have that level of, like even with paranoid personality, you have that level of suspiciousness and that level of motivation. You know, you're poisoning me. I'm not going to take that because they will go down a whole holistic route and, you know, look up every possible side effect and say this and this and this, and you know, think that they're being targeted. Even they think the pharmacist is giving them the wrong pill, and the pill was switched at the pharmacy. So, you know, when you have, you know, whether it's, you know, delusional disorder or schizotypal or schizophrenia or any of the psychotic disorders, when paranoia and mistrust and suspiciousness are operating at a very high level, getting an individual to, one, be, you know, medication compliant or even begin to consider taking medication Sometimes respond to like intramuscular injections, but other time, you know, it's so a crucial variable and, you know, psychotherapeutically is being able to establish a strong therapeutic alliance with an individual. And that is such an important part, not always easy to do because they're constantly waiting for the other shoe to drop or for you to lie to them or for you to mistreat them or you cancel an appointment. It's because you were going on a date with their best friend or whatever. So, working through that suspiciousness and helping them to gain a better sense of themselves and a better sense of being grounded and you know, validating. It is workable. It's treatable. But again, they're not coming in with the, you know, the schizotypal, you know, please, you know, treat me for this. But once it's revealed through, you know, a full evaluation, and you can articulate, and I've had great success in being able to be doing the feedback to articulate, this is what is going on, and here's the diagnosis. I have found in my experience, people have tended to be much more receptive. And that is one of the hardest parts of what I do is the feedback session, is being able to articulate with the integrity of what the findings are, respect for the sanctity of the other people sitting across from me, whether it's an individual and their family, a child or adolescent, and you know their parents or family, spouse. I mean, so being communicating that, I take a lot of time and try my best to articulate this with you know, here are the findings. Explaining them to the best I can in a way that we have a common dialogue, and also being able to instill a sense of hope that with treatment and with therapy and medication for, you know, whatever the diagnosis is, whether it's schizotypal or not, instilling a sense of hope, not false hope, but hope that if you do the work, you can eliminate a lot of things and kick a lot of things into remission. But that is, from my perspective, one of the most difficult parts of what I do is to communicate with, because I want to also honor the integrity and the seriousness of whatever the diagnoses are, but also really I make it a point to clarify that whatever the findings are is something that you have, is not something that you are, and not to define yourselves by those things. And I've seen that label. I've seen people wear those labels like it's just as much as they hate it, it's just how they view themselves and as dysfunctional as their life might be. You know, they may, you know, express a desire to change and not feel or think or act a certain way, but sometimes that fear can be so paralyzing because they're so used to whatever this other lifestyle, like I said, as dysfunctional as it might be. Sometimes that fear can be crippling and paralyzing to the point where they just haven't gotten to the place where they're uncomfortable enough to make the changes. All right. So hopefully this was helpful. Continue to reach out through psychologyunplugged@outlook.com. Follow us on psychology, or get a hold of me through Psychology Today. You can follow us on Instagram at psychology_unplugged_. I do my best to get back to as many people as possible. And thank you for continuing to be on this journey with us. I appreciate all of your feedback. And I will talk to you guys next week. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. And be well. Bye, guys.